climate change is essentially racist because it impacts disproportionately people of color. It is essentially the global south that are paying the biggest price for it. And I think the way in which it was framed for a very long time was essentially at the expense of people of color.
Hi, I'm Alana Weston, chairman of Selfridges Group, and welcome to How to Lead a Sustainable Business, the podcast where I speak to the pioneers who are driving us towards a greener future. Today, I'll be speaking with activist and student politician Zemzem Ibrahim. Zemzem is the former president of the National Union of Students and currently serves as the president of the educational charity Students Organizing for Sustainability, which was created by the NUS in response to the climate and ecological crisis. Her campaigns have highlighted that the climate crisis is deeply intertwined with issues of social justice and inequality, and that what is needed is a fundamental shift in the education system to give young people the tools and agency they need to fight for a greener, fairer future. To start with, I wanted to find out a bit more about her personal journey into student politics.
My journey into student politics is a little unconventional. I think from my background, I wasn't necessarily ever like a activist. Like I would never use those words, or I was never a campaigner. For me, like it started with like my first ever lecture at university. We were all very packed in and I was like, you expect me to sit on the floor if I come like 2 minutes late? Well, that's not happening. And I remember like marching up to the head of year and being like, well, this isn't enough. Like you need to do better. She looked at me and she said, I'll sort out the issue. As long as you promise me you'll become a student rep. And so I became a student rep. And then I got involved in like my local union and then went on to becoming the national president. I went through a journey of political education that I never got as a young person. And really started to understand the power that we hold as individuals and the change that we can make through education. And also really understand, like, actually, a lot of the things that I've been fighting all my life suddenly had words to it, you know? Like I understood, like, how systemic inequalities played out. I knew I experienced them, but I never knew what they were. Like, I wasn't ever able to, like, explain it in that way. And I think for me, like, the political education that I went through at university kind of has shaped the person I am now.
I like that story. I think it's amazing when you suddenly are able to have the language to talk about, in a political way, some of the emotions that you feel as a person. And it's that connection between the personal and the political that is so key to making change happen. You said in one of your talks that at first you didn't see the connection between social justice and climate change. Can you describe what made you realize the two were linked? Was this a gradual dawning or was there a eureka moment?
Honestly, I think it was definitely like a eureka moment, because the reality is, like, to a lot of us, when we hear about like climate change and we hear about sustainable practices, it's done under the frame of like, let's save the polar bears, what about the turtles? And when you come from a background of like deprivation, you see poverty all around you. You know, you see your family and friends struggling to like figure out where they're going to eat next, how they're going to pay rent next month, where I explicitly face racism and sexism and Islamophobia, you think to yourself, like, I couldn't care less about the polar bears. Mm. And for me, for a long time, I was unable to understand that world because it never tried to understand me.
Right.
And for me, when Asad Rahman made that link at a conference that I was at, he basically very simply said that climate change is essentially racist. Right? Because it impacts disproportionately people of color. It is essentially the global south that are paying the biggest price for it. And I think the way in which it was framed for a very long time was essentially at the expense of people of color. And when he spoke about it, I started to think about the impacts that the country that I'm from, Somalia, the mass droughts that have happened in Somalia and the land that my father grew up in his father and his father's father, knowing that actually that entire land and that infrastructure and that history of my family of farmers no longer exists because of the impacts that haven't been caused by Somalia, that haven't been caused by the global south at all. I think that was kind of my eureka moment, being like, actually, just because it hasn't been framed as my issue doesn't make it my issue. And what I need to do is allow people to understand it from the perspective I understand it. It started off with me putting together a campaign calling essentially like, your climate change is racist. And it was targeted at like environmental organizations. It was targeted at universities and colleges who are doing work around sustainability, but like for them to understand it from that intersectional point of view.
It's interesting. You've noticed that people of color are often underrepresented in environmental activism. Could you explain why that might be and why it's important that that changes?
I think the way in which environmentalism has been framed for years has always targeted more of a middle-class background. And I think when a pivotal campaign to all of us is framed in such an elitist way, it's kind of taken away from the wider community. But also at the same time, sustainability has been like framed as like a feel-good action rather than what's important for us to live in a fair and just society. Whether it was like people cutting down on their meat intake and being like, oh, look at me, I'm doing a great thing for the environment, or like no longer like filling up a bottle rather than like having a plastic bottle. To me, those are things that we should be doing regardless, because at the end of the day, this is your planet. Like we all live on this planet, like every single one of us. And so behaviors are changing now. And I think there's more of an accountability in terms of understanding that like actually me deciding to like clean up my local community isn't an act of charity. It is my community. It's where I live, you know?
Can you tell us a little bit about Students Organizing for Sustainability and what are its goals?
So Students Organizing for Sustainability is a organization we set up a year ago, really focused around transforming our education system. And for me, like I've always believed that you can't change a system without changing the people that are going to run that system and be a part of that system. And so education to me has always been like that key moment, that pivotal moment where you make that systemic change. And so the way in which our young people are educated has a huge impact on the leaders they're going to be tomorrow. And for me, the systemic change really needed to happen at nursery, at primary school, when you're really shaping the way a child thinks. One of the things that I've always found like incredibly inspiring is when you speak to young people and allow them to like tell you how they can reimagine the world that they live in and rethink what a just and sustainable and a fair world looks like, they will paint you a pretty realistic picture, but actually an incredible picture that a lot of us can't think about because we've been socialized in a certain way where we can't think out of the bubble of like, well, this can't happen because of this, 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 right? One of the things that I find so incredibly important, so incredibly pivotal, is that like we can't kill that. That's what we need to nurture. That's what we need to grow. And then we have like a bunch of campaigns that from like divestment campaigns running at universities and colleges. We run campaigns in terms of like certifying a lot of NGOs and like universities, colleges, a lot of educational establishments on like how they can be sustainable, how they can be net zero. We run a specific campaign on retrofitting schools and buildings and making sure the environment that we learn in is also just and sustainable. And so, yeah, there's a lot of different like aspects to the work that we do in SOS.
I'm interested in the way you've identified that outmoded education systems produce outmoded and unprepared leadership when it comes to addressing some of the biggest problems facing the planet. Can you describe what you'd like to change about the system?
Yeah, I mean, I think the example that I always use for people to understand how out of date our education system is that like 150 to 200 years ago, our education systems were like set up in a very robust way. And an academic comes and stands in front of you, they tell you what you need to learn and you write that down and that's the end of the lesson. And that system exists almost in every single classroom across the UK. And it's a system that has been seen as like the elite way to learn, has been amplified and copied by the rest of the world. Because as Brits, we lead on like what great education systems look like. But the reality is like, nobody would like take a horse to London from Manchester. That's insane. You'd be like, that's the ways to get from A to B now. And so like, just like how everything else around us has been able to develop and be taught smarter and to be used more effectively and more efficiently, the key purpose to it has completely remained the same. there's going to be a cracking point. There's going to be a moment in which we are behind. Like, Norway's adopting different ways of teaching and different models who are like becoming more and more effective. And I think like the rest of the world are going to slowly catch up. But I think like you can't expect the most bright and elite leaders to actually tap into those talents that they have, you know, expand into those talents, when actually all the education system does right now is fail them. And so I think as young people who are going through these systems, who are like socialized in a way where we're actually like constantly reinforced by society, by our institutions, by our education systems, just constantly being told that like we can't change things, we don't have power, we don't have agency, it's hard to build hope out of that. And I know for me, being a leader and being put in positions where I'm having to remind myself, actually, I do have agency and I do have power. And I play a role in reminding other people that they have that power also. But realistically, I can't blame young people when they feel like that, because I know exactly where that, I guess, where that's coming from, and how that's being reinforced inside them.
It strikes me that as we, as leaders, we're looking more and more for these people who are able to manage complexity. I think that's going to be crucial. And in talking to the different thinkers in this podcast, those are the kinds of skills that we need for the future. When I work with leaders, we're often talking about how we can take a more of a coaching approach and a more collaborative approach and flatter structures. But none of those are taught in school, because it's very didactic and there's going to be one person that's going to tell a whole group what to think. And so how can we expect those people when they come into work to not model that same behavior? But I like the way that you're saying that this is deeply ingrained from when we start going to school. And until we change that, and until we change some of the other inputs that young people have, we're not going to get the societal change that we need to deal with these big problems.
And I think like a lot of organizations, I think in terms of like making that change and like adopting a pool of like talent, is understanding that like we all have different barriers and when we go into our education system. And being a Black Muslim woman, I remember like from primary school being told that I was never good enough on certain things. I remember when I was picking my university courses and I picked University of Manchester, my teacher telling me, "You sure you're going to get into that university?" And I did get into that university, but it was always like constantly being told that you're not good enough for this. And that doubt really creeps into you. There's a report around this equality charter where university students, specifically Black sounding names, are racialized against and are given lower grades than their white counterparts. And so actually to understand that when we talk about diversity quotas and when organizations are talking about like recruiting talent, I think you can't recruit talent without being mindful of the fact that people of color have been held back.
Yeah.
So for them to be in that position to be able to apply and have the grades that you require to come to your organization, know that actually they're probably far more talented had they the opportunity to sprint forward. Because we pretend like, oh, this is leveling out the playing field. We're absolutely not leveling out the playing field. That's not what you're doing. What you're doing is actually recognizing that there is a lack of talent, and actually to understand that the lack of diversity in your organization actually holds you back as an organization. And actually thinking about it from the aspect of like, actually, what talent are we missing out on? What don't we understand? What conversations are not happening in this room because people are excluded from it?
I completely agree. And when you've got these really complex, difficult problems to solve, you need the best brains in the room, but they can't all think the same way. And it's only by having that diversity and experience and upbringing and everything that will make us solve problems in really creative ways. And speaking of that, you once said that one of the reasons you didn't go into the corporate world was because you didn't want to be part of the problem. Do you think it's possible for business to be part of the solution to climate change? And what would it take to convince you that they were serious about sustainability?
I think absolutely. For me, like, of course, like we need businesses and they are like pivotal and important to our community, to our economy. But there are a lot of changes that need to happen. And I think when, for me, like currently the way in which our economic system and business, the way in which they compete, a lot of them are forced into working in very unsustainable ways just to survive. And I think actually, like, a lot of the big businesses have a huge role to play in being able to set themselves aside and put people over profit. Realistically, when I chose to go to university, I chose accounting and finance because I was good at maths and I enjoyed like finance. And I looked up like best paid jobs in like the business field. I looked up accounting and I was like, that's probably the best paid job. I'm going to go for that. And that's realistically why I did accounting. Coming from a background where like my parents really, really sacrificed a lot to get me to where I am and give me the support that I got through university, all I wanted to do was like, at that moment in time, is to put my family out of poverty and like to be in a place where I know I can provide for them and give them a house. And like, that was my only motivation going into like university. And so I was like, I'm going to make as much money as possible and like buy my mom a house, buy my dad a car, and they're all going to be happy. And of course, like I went through like a political education through university and I thought maybe not the best route, but I think at the time, for me, like I realized that actually I would have become an accountant and I would have worked for one of the big companies because that's what you do. And then it would have just been a part, it would have been that cycle. I would have just got stuck in that cycle. And there's nothing wrong with like that cycle. And there's nothing wrong with like being able to provide for your family and be able to support your family. But I think for me, I saw an opportunity to influence bigger change. And that's why I didn't go into the corporate world. And I'm like, use my expertise and like my contacts to be able to influence and change that corporate world, to be able to unpick it for those big organizations to understand the role that they play in really changing the status quo. Like, I think it's always like it's kind of like a domino effect. You often have like 1, 2, 3 big organizations that do like very radical work and have a ripple effect on many other organizations.
What is it about young people that, I guess, maybe a little different to when I was growing up? They don't seem to be interested in being lectured or told what to think, whether that's by a professor or a brand. People seem a lot more political at a very young age. How do you think students are different to how they were, say, when your parents were growing up?
I think we are probably far more connected and therefore like have information at our fingertips than ever before. I think rather than me forming my education or like my knowledge from asking my parents or the people that are around me, I can go do that full-blown research on the internet. And I think that's really what's made people politically educated, because they have that information at their fingertips. And are utilizing that and have like turned like every like social media platform into like a political tool. For me, like that's what makes us different. Like we have the ability to connect almost instantly. We have the ability to know exactly what's happening right now in Uganda. Like right now, specifically like Nigeria has been protesting for weeks. And like I've been keeping up with that and monitoring that because of my Twitter. We feel like we're in a global village. Like, you know, in a weird way, like whenever I talk to my mom about like some of the stuff that are happening like on the other side of the world and how I feel so connected to that. And I will often like feel like I have to offer my support and like my solidarity or do some work around that and some action and mobilize around that in the UK. Mom will look at me and be like, why do you care? You're on the other side of the world. And like, to me, it's kind of like, well, it's my fight because we're in this together. It's that connectedness that we feel to issues that are happening like on the other side of the world. Yes. That I guess my parents just could never understand.
And so for those young people, what are they looking for? What are their needs? You know, they're going to be our future customers as business people. What are the kinds of things they're looking for from brands, from business, from leaders for the future?
I mean, I think, and I've said this before, I think young people are going to like vote with their feet. They're going to lead like with their wallets. And are more and more making now like decisions that are just and sustainable and fair. And I think as like businesses, they need to really think about like how they can cater to that and how they can ensure that they operate in a just and sustainable way. And that they not only think about the profits that they're going to make, but actually how they as a business impact their community. What influence do they have? What message are they sending through wherever they're marketing and whatever they're putting together? as long as you build a business with the community in mind, as long as you put together a strategy with the world that you want to see, then that business is going to be a success. Organizations that are like exploiting people for work aren't going to be utilized by young people. I personally now absolutely don't shop for any company that I know are exploiting workers. And I think that's an important value to me. And that's an important value to a lot of young people. Like I know it'll take one TikTok to be made for like one organization to be completely boycotted tomorrow. And I think what makes us so unafraid is because we know we have each other. I almost know that I can start something today or like talk about an issue today. And I know I'll have thousands and thousands of young people supporting me within minutes. And I think that's important because then I feel like I have power back. As much as power has been tried to be taken away from me, I feel like I have it. And I think that's what makes us different.
I mean, I really admire your courage and I think you have a fantastic energy and passion. And it makes me very hopeful to feel that and to see what you're going to do next. So thank you so much, Simsim, for your time and please keep going.
Thank you so much. No, I enjoyed this and I definitely will.
I hope you found my conversation with Simsim as inspiring as I did. This is the last episode of the series, though we hope to bring you some more exciting episodes in the new year. Throughout this whole process, I feel that the overall theme that's emerged has been the priority of shifting mindset in business leaders and their employees. It's the only way we're going to see the systemic changes we need for businesses to thrive in the new green economy. In the next series, we hope to take a look at some of the more pragmatic steps that leaders have taken to reshape their companies and embrace ambitious sustainable practices. In the meantime, please do subscribe, rate, and share the podcast so we can reach as many people as possible. This episode was brought to you by Selfridges Group and Radio Wolfgang. The producer was Eli Block, and the production manager was Katie Fuller. Thank you once again to Simsim Ibrahim. I'm Alana Weston, and this is How to Lead a Sustainable Business.